open architecture, where the Navy isn't locked into a particular vendor forever on a particular system, gets a huge boost from the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Jonathan Greener. You can read his views at federalnewsradio.com. My colleague Jared Serby reporting on that. The Navy has a unique chance to reshape its fleet in the coming years. Brian Clark is a senior fellow of strategic studies at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, former special assistant to the Chief of Naval Operations and director of the CNO's Commander's Action Group. He believes the driving principle behind that reshaping should be the concept of offensive sea control.
Offensive sea control has to do with the idea of getting out of a defensive mindset in our surface fleet and getting on offense, meaning I want to be able to shoot the enemy's airplanes and submarines and surface ships before they can shoot me, rather than just waiting and letting them fire upon me and then defending against those attacks. Today's surface fleet is really only capable of defending itself. It's not capable of going out and reaching the enemy's platforms and destroying them before they're able to launch attacks. So fundamentally, that's what this study is about, is enabling the surface fleet to get back on offense, as it was able to do during the Cold War, the last time we had a big challenge for the Navy and the U.S. military.
So if that's the last time we were capable of doing that, is losing that capability a result of drawdowns after the Cold War, or changes in philosophy over the interim decades, or some combination, or something else?
It's a great way to put it. So one part is a change in philosophy. So after the Cold War and the loss of that major maritime competitor, the Navy was able to start using the surface fleet for other things than using it for offensive sea control. The surface fleet does Tomahawk attacks. It does counter-piracy. It does ballistic missile defense. So all these new missions came along, and the Navy had the luxury of being able to pursue them because there were no real competitors for sea control around the world. The other part of this is adversary capabilities have improved. And so if you look at the missile competition, if you will, between U.S. surface ships and foreign and potential enemy surface ships, the missile ranges that they're both capable of is dramatically different today. Whereas in the Cold War, we could attack enemy aircraft, surface ships, and submarines outside the range of their missiles. Today, they're able to attack us well before we're able to engage them. And that missile relationship is very disadvantageous to it. But it came about as a result of this change in mindset towards defense, because we didn't really have a big competitor. And also, there were some decisions made with regard to where you spend money. So we didn't spend as much money on building the kind of weapons capacity and capability that you need.
You're pretty specific in this report, writing, you're not proposing a new architecture for the surface fleet. Instead, this work focuses on modifications to the inventory that you have now, I'm paraphrasing, that can be fielded by 2025. Why is that important in your view,
Brian? Well, Francis, I thought it was really important that instead of an aspirational study that looks far into the future to try to define what the future architecture of the surface fleet should be, which is something a lot of studies tend to do, I wanted to pull it into a time frame in which we could really affect change with today's decisions and have a set of actionable steps that could be done within the fiscal constraints we're likely to have. So between now and 2025, Navy can do quite a bit to enhance the capability of the surface fleet, but it won't be able to build a new surface fleet from scratch. It won't be able to build a new surface combatant. There's not the money for it, and there's really not the time for it either. Also, around 2025 is when the Navy's going to have to start building the new ballistic missile submarine, which is going to take a big chunk of the Navy's shipbuilding budget. So trying to have a surface fleet construct built around some new ship, it wouldn't be really executable until after that ship, the Ohio replacement program, has already been constructed, which won't happen until the 2030s. And then maybe the Navy can think about a new surface fleet architecture.
You anticipated one of my next questions, which is how much of that timeline is influenced by strategy and how much of it's influenced by money. You articulated that a little bit. Can you expand on that?
Well, there's a little bit. There's driven by strategy as well. And so one thing I talked about in the study is the idea that between now and 2025, the anti-access networks that some of our potential adversaries like Iran and China and some other countries are developing are going to mature. And so by 2025, we will really have to have a robust capability to defend against anti-access capabilities like anti-ship ballistic missiles and anti-ship cruise missiles and submarines. And we'll also have to have the ability to go on offense and defeat those threats before they're able to launch attacks on the U.S. fleet. How we kind of do things today is we depend to a large degree for sea control on other parts of the joint force other than surface ships. And that's largely because those other parts have been available to lend a hand in sea control. But what's likely to happen in future conflicts is they're going to be increasingly maritime in nature. And so the aircraft carrier and its carrier air wing, submarines, amphibious warships are going to be purposed towards power projection, taking the fight ashore. And they aren't going to be able to spare the time and the resources to go do sea control. They're going to depend on the surface fleet to do that, which is why it's imperative that the surface fleet develop the ability to go and take the fight to the enemy and take and hold areas of ocean.
From a budget perspective, is what you're proposing doable at the same time as we're developing that Ohio class replacement program?
Definitely. All the actions I identified in this report are achievable within the Navy's projected top-line budget. And I did that specifically because I was concerned about the fiscal constraints we're likely to be under if sequestration or the Budget Control Act caps continue to be in place, which they would be under current law until 2021. So it wouldn't be reasonable to propose a set of changes for the Navy that don't fit within those budget caps. And so that's why I focused to a large degree on the study on things you can do with payloads, if you will, instead of the platforms themselves. So new weapons, new sensors, modifications to existing ships, taking ships that currently are used for other purposes and enabling them to do new missions that take some of the stress off the rest of the fleet. And that's really where I focus the effort is on those kind of executable actions that are achievable within the budget constraints we're likely to have.
I want to come back to that platforms concept and talk about that. But you mentioned anti-access capabilities vis-a-vis China and Iran.
Right.
A number of people believe that we're on, if not already engaged in a Cold War with Russia now, we're on a trajectory to that.
Right.
How does that influence this mix?
Yeah, so Russia is a very interesting case. In the Cold War, Russia was able to create something of an anti-access network, if you will, up in the Northern Atlantic and down in the Eastern Mediterranean. And those were areas where the U.S. Navy was going to deploy to be able to take some of the pressure off the Central Front, if you will, in the Cold War, when it was anticipated that Soviet ground troops would be streaming across Germany. We had the Army and all the rest of the NATO armies there fighting. That's the main line of effort. We were going to take the Navy and use it on the periphery in the Mediterranean and up in the Northern Atlantic to drive the Russians to have to think about a wider conflict and dilute their forces. So what they've done is they've continued to develop those kinds of capabilities. So the Russians are really the source of the most advanced surface-to-air missiles, most advanced anti-ship cruise missiles, and most advanced electronic warfare systems that are out there today. They're going to continue to develop those and use them, and to the degree that their geography would allow them to use it, they're going to employ those anti-access capabilities and, more importantly, sell them to other countries. So the things that China has today are all derivative of Russian systems, which you see down in Syria today, for example. Those are all Russian systems that have been deployed, and those are already causing headaches for the U.S. Navy in the Eastern Mediterranean, where they have to deal with the fact that you've got Russian-made systems in Syria that could potentially threaten ships or airplanes operating in that area.
Mm-hmm. As that continues, what are the projections that we need to look at? Maybe even things you didn't address in this report, but what activities, what events could necessitate a change in the way that we look at least at Russia in that anti-access capability arena?
Right. So some things to look at are currently Russia is deploying a lot more forces overseas now to kind of show its force, show its capability, show its readiness, its military readiness. So you've heard reports about bomber flights being done, you know, training and readiness flights, surveillance flights being done. They're executing more of those. They're doing more naval deployments overseas with submarines and with surface ships. So the continued ramp up in those deployments would be one thing to watch. The other thing to watch is how they're exercising their forces when they are away from Russia, in particular looking at some of these anti-access capabilities. One thing that Russia has always had as a strength from a military perspective has been electronic warfare. And I would note that that's one area where the Russians are starting to flex their muscles, because you can exercise those capabilities, and since they're non-kinetic, they sometimes are perceived as being less threatening than a kinetic weapon like a missile or a bomb. So I'd look at how Russia's exercising itself, and I'd look particularly at how it's testing its new systems, because those systems, even if Russia doesn't use them, they're likely to fall into the hands of some of Russia's friends or paramilitary proxies, like you saw in Georgia, where Russian-made systems made their way into the hands of paramilitary forces. They could send some of their more advanced systems into the hands of those people as well.
That's Brian Clark, a senior fellow of strategic studies at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. My conversation with him continuing in a moment on Federal News Radio. Be right back.
Cross and Blue Shield champions the fearless in all of us.
To me, fearless is leaving last year's you in the dust. So now I'm hitting the pavement instead of the snooze bar and getting rewarded with fitness discounts, wellness incentives, and a wealth of other benefits for federal employees. So soon, the old me will just be a thing of the past.
Blue Cross and Blue Shield Federal Employee Program. Live fearless. To learn more, call 1-800-411-BLUE or visit fearless.fepblue.org.
Attention, civilian federal employees. You're probably aware of your Fegley life insurance options, but did you know you can obtain economical group life insurance coverage through WAPA? WAPA is an independent nonprofit association formed in 1943, dedicated to serving the health, welfare, and financial well-being of civilian federal employees. To learn more about WAPA and their group term life program, visit WAPA.org. That's WAEPA.org. WAPA's group term life insurance product offers coverage from $25,000 up to $750,000. And through their associate member program, even your spouse and non-dependent adult children can also get group term life insurance coverage from $25,000 up to $750,000 through WAPA. By the way, they're not required to be civilian federal employees to apply for this coverage.
The WAPA Group Term Life Program is not endorsed by the federal government. Coverage is provided by Life Insurance Company of North America and is subject to insurer approval with evidence of good health. This policy contains exclusions and benefits may reduce by age.
When you hear the Salvation Army bells this Christmas, know you are doing the most good to feed and to shelter your neighbors.
After having no place to go, the Salvation Army took me in. The Salvation Army is helping me turn my life around.
When you hear our bells this holiday season, please support the Salvation Army's mission to feed and shelter our neighbors in D.C., Maryland, and Northern Virginia.
We are the Salvation Army of the National Capital Area, doing the most good.
Want to save money on vitamins, herbal remedies, and other health care needs? Then visit Village Green Apothecary during our big year-end sale now through December 31st. You'll save 35% on our popular Pathway brand nutrition products, 25% off other supplements, and 20% off natural body care products. Visit us at 5415 West Cedar Lane in Bethesda or shop online at myvillagegreen.com. And be sure to catch our top-notch radio show, Essentials of Healthy Living, every Sunday at 10 a.m. Essentials of Healthy Living is sponsored by Enzymatic Therapy and Nordic Naturals.
This is Mark Amtower. If you're looking for cost-effective and efficient methods for marketing your products or services to the government or to other government contractors, look to LinkedIn. There are over 400,000 members in the D.C. area and more than 92 million nationwide, but only a small percentage actually use it well. I can show you how to leverage LinkedIn in ways that support your marketing, sales, and business development efforts. I do this for large and small companies, and I can do it for you. Drop me a line at mark@federaldirect.net.
Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. Five new concepts or approaches are key to the Navy regaining its offensive edge, according to Brian Clark of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. He writes about each of those five in a new publication called Commanding the Seas, a plan to reinvigorate U.S. Navy surface warfare.
You write, regaining its ability to conduct offensive sea control requires the surface fleet to implement new concepts and approaches to address several significant shortfalls. I want to list each of these and ask you to tell me where we're short right now and what would fix that. The first is offensive weapons capacity per ship, and I think of LCS immediately. The main complaint against that platform seems to be not enough firepower.
Right. And so there's a couple of dimensions of that. So the first dimension is right now our cruisers and destroyers who have the vertical launch system missile tubes, most of those tubes in wartime are going to be taken up with air defense missiles. Just to defend that ship and the rest of the fleet that it's protecting, which means it doesn't have very much capacity left over for offensive weapons. And then in the LCS case, as you mentioned, has really no offensive capacity other than what might be brought on board as part of its mission package. So very limited in terms of its capacity as well as the range of those systems. So what I'm advocating in the report, first of all, is for the Navy to adopt a new air defense concept that shifts the current way it does air defense, which is a very long-range layered approach where I'm going to shoot incoming aircraft and missiles multiple times before they arrive at the target, to instead a much denser single layer. And they think about the example of Iron Dome in Israel. And that's how Iron Dome works, is it's a very dense, relatively close layer that guards the protected area rather than a really long-range system that would defend the entire state of Israel, if you will. You can generate a lot more capacity that way because the missiles that you use for that air defense system are smaller and cheaper, and you can have them carried in much larger numbers. The same thing would apply to surface ships. If you use a smaller interceptor that goes out to a shorter range, you can carry a lot more of them. You can afford to buy a lot more of them. And that would allow you to shift some of your VLS capacity to offensive weapons.
Second item is air defense density and cost.
Right, which relates directly to that idea. So once you've shifted to a new air defense concept, you're going to free up space for offensive missiles, and you also improve your air defense capability, because one problem we have today is if you have 100 interceptor missiles on your ship, all the adversary has to do is launch enough cruise missiles at you to use up all those 100 interceptors, and now you're stuck. Mm-hmm. So if you were instead to shift to a model where you could carry two or three or four times as many missiles because they're smaller, then you can force the adversary to have to use a much larger number of weapons, which may not be practical for him at a certain point.
Next is overall weapons capability. That's just the raw firepower, right?
Right. And so one thing that the Navy and the military is doing in general, which is problematic, is the current approach to weapons development is they tend towards single mission weapons, meaning I'm building a land attack missile, or I'm building an anti-ship missile, or I'm building an anti-air missile. And then the weapons themselves tend to have large warheads that make a big boom when they get there, but they don't necessarily have the range and speed that they could have. So one thing I'm advocating is that we take a new approach to weapons development, primarily in the Navy, but then maybe broadly as well, where we focus on making sure that the weapon has a relevant capability. And for the Navy, as I mentioned, range is the biggest shortfall right now, as we're not able to outrange our enemies. And then the second thing is that the weapons be as small as possible. So we drive down the size of the weapons primarily by going with smaller warheads, because we're going against more sophisticated targets. A smaller warhead would be sufficient to render it unusable, even if it doesn't obliterate it from the planet. And then the third thing is to make them as multi-mission as possible, because the number of vertical launch system cells on a ship is finite. It's not going to change, and I can't really reload at sea very easily to change the mix of weapons. So if I have a multi-mission weapon and my mission changes over the course of my deployment, I can easily shift from having the same capacity for one mission as I do for another mission. An example of that would be our ships today go out with Tomahawk land attack missiles, which people are familiar with, and they go out with air defense missiles. And then if your mission changes to be from primarily air defense to primarily strike, I'd have to go back into port, and ships do, to change out a bunch of their missiles so they can have more missiles for the new mission. Well, if those Tomahawk missiles were capable of doing anti-ship, anti-air, or land attack type missions, they'd be able to have the same capacity for each mission. And you could do that in part by relying on a smaller warhead.
The next point is overall surface fleet offensive capacity. Where are we lacking there?
Well, the size of the surface fleet, the Navy's requirement for surface, large surface combatants in particular, is 88 ships, which they are almost at today. But as we get into the future, financial constraints are going to start to cause that number to go down. So one thing the Navy's proposed doing this year in their budget was to do a phased modernization of its cruisers, which would allow them to temporarily take them out of active use and put them in reduced operating status, and then bring them back over time and do a phased modernization and life extension as they come back into the fleet. And that would allow the Navy to stretch out the lifetimes of those cruisers for a longer period of time into the time period in which we're building this new ballistic missile submarine, when funds are going to be tight. And that's a way to save money while also increasing the capacity of the surface fleet going forward. And the other aspect of this is LCS and the new small surface combatant the Navy's building. If you give those ships the ability to do offensive missions, that would allow you to enhance the overall offensive capacity of the fleet. Because if you put, for example, vertical launch system on LCS and make that your small surface combatant, you'd be able to use those VLS cells for offensive missions just like you do the ones in a destroyer or a cruiser.
And that small surface combatant capacity is the last item on your list of new concepts. Does that require a whole refitting or a whole new package for LCS for that platform to be able to do that?
The changes are fairly minimal, and I've gone down and visited both shipyards that build LCS and talked extensively with the designers and the engineers down there. Both types of LCS could accommodate the modifications that would enable it to become this new small surface combatant and give it offensive capability as well as having greater defensive capability. And those modifications are really just to install a vertical launch system magazine of 16 to 24 cells on it, putting a different three-dimensional radar on it, which would not be extremely expensive, and then having it permanently install the ASW mission or anti-submarine warfare mission package that the ship currently would carry and just permanently installing that on the ship.
I know I don't mean to pick on LCS,
right.
But we have an incoming chairman of the SASC that's already skeptical of the entire program.
Right.
And I'm not familiar with Congressman Thornberry's position on the LCS. But I wonder about the political implications of going back to them and saying, we'd like to build more capability or a different capability for this platform that you're already unsure of.
Right. Well, the concerns with LCS really stem from two issues. One is LCS ended up being more expensive than the Navy originally characterized it as. And over time, that cost has come down, and now it's actually commensurate with what the original cost estimates would have been, because the building them in numbers has caused the learning curve to occur, and so the shipbuilders are getting better at building them for the right price. So the Navy's got actually getting them for a pretty good price now, and it seems like from what I've discussed or read from Congress that they're relatively happy with the way the program's going from a financial perspective. The other concern that has become more of a concern of late is the capability in the ship, and the fact that the ship lacks sort of an inherent capability to do offensive missions and lacks sufficient defense to be able to adequately defend itself and other ships, because one big mission that the frigates originally did that the LCS was intended to replace was an escort-type mission against Soviet bombers and ships that would have attempted to attack convoys that NATO depended upon in a wartime scenario. So the firepower part of it is as an offensive and defensive component. But it seemed like Congress was receptive to the idea of putting vertical launch system or some kind of magazine on there that would enable it to have offensive and defensive capabilities, and making that the new small surface combatant. There didn't seem to be resistance to that idea. The resistance was LCS, as currently constituted, just didn't have the capability they believed it needed to have. And obviously the SecDef and the SecNav agreed.
That's Brian Clark, Senior Fellow of Strategic Studies at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessment.